Welcome back to the CMAS podcast, everybody. Mike, Will, Tim, and I are joined today by my dear friend and brother in Christ, Connor. I met Connor when I lived in New Smyrna Beach, Florida, and went to the gym one day, and he was going absolutely crazy. And we really shared a lot of similar energy, and then started having some interesting, deep conversations. And we were at two very different points in our spiritual journey. At the time, I was very slowly leaving some pretty staunch atheism. And Connor will share where he was in just a minute here. And 4 years later, we're both in also very interesting places. I'm back in the church, and Connor's going to tell you where he's at. And we were having a phone conversation about a week ago. And I was sharing with Connor the experience that Mike had with Will. And Connor basically said, "How come you didn't do that for me?" And I was like, you know what? That's a really good question. You know, that is my responsibility. And unlike many people who are interested in theology and God in a superficial way or in an aggressive way, Connor has a true heart of humility. And I think this is going to be a tremendously productive conversation. So I wanted to bring him on, and we are just going to discuss with Connor where he's at spiritually, his perspective on the Catholic faith, and his journey. And so to start off, I just want to give him a few minutes here to tell us about himself, where he came from, and then where he's at right now. So thanks so much for doing this, Connor. It's a big act of courage. I think it's going to help a lot of guys.
Well, thanks, Nick. I really do appreciate it. And I'm glad that I could rib you a little bit. And then you guys give me the opportunity to come on here and engage with you and ask some questions. So 2020, I suppose, met Nick at the gym. And I was very newly at least trying to explore truth and faith. And I think most of that came from a desire to know anything. I was raised Catholic, was baptized and confirmed and took First Communion. And yet I don't really remember my father ever reading the Bible to me or reading stories of the saints or the martyrs or church history, which there's so many awesome and great stories there. So what I would say is that as far as I can remember, my heart and my mind were never really captivated by the church or Christ. He did do a good job of still instilling virtue in me as a young man and a child. And we did read a lot of Tolkien and a lot of good literature. But I would say that generally I was adrift religiously, although we did participate weekly about till the age I was 12, maybe 13, regularly in a Catholic church that he was actually a donor for. They had built a new church, and he had donated the concrete for it and had like a benefactor relationship with the church there. And we always had a priest that he had a relationship with that I believe married my mother and him. And he would come and give the mass for us, and he would come stay with us and have vacation and stay at our home. And so I saw, in a sense, what that type of piety looked like in a priest, but I had nothing really to stick it to. Or at least that's what it seemed like looking back now. So at about 14, we had stopped attending at all. I was going to an Episcopal school that was very liberal. And yet I still loved good stories about courage and truth and sacrifice. I can remember, I was thinking about this last night, I can remember reading A Tale of Two Cities. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with it, but the end is very powerful. And the one of the main characters, he quotes Bible scripture as he goes to the conclusion of the story. I don't want to ruin it for you guys. Spoiler alert if you haven't read it. And I just remember weeping as a young man. And he's talking about the resurrection of life, and I know it's in all the gospels. But essentially, he has courage as he faces sure death. And so, anyways, I guess I wrestled with those things, right? Being exposed to the church, seeing piety, being baptized, but not really, as far as I know, even now, like having really knowledge transferred to me or anybody really kind of teach me in the faith at all. And so, I guess what I would say is I love the world. I fell in love with the world. I started to drink and use drugs at a really young age, and fornicate. And I basically persisted in that lifestyle for about 20 years, and finally was just tired of being afraid to die. I think that's one thing that I'm grateful for, that I hope, held from my baptism, is that God is who he says he is. He's evident in, how he expresses himself in the world naturally, and then also through the scriptures. And some of those things stuck with me. And so I knew that I was a sinner, but I didn't know how to not be a sinner. And so I hated myself. So one day I went to AA. I wanted to get sober so bad, and I was finally almost OD'd, and was just scared, shitless. And went to an AA meeting, and a man told me to go to church. And the only Christian I knew was my grandmother, who's this, God lover. I mean, she's a wonderful woman. I love her. And but she, Pentecostal, very surface level American Christianity, and yet she's, existed in it for 80 years. She's 90. But I went there and I met a man, and he began to at least use the scriptures to train me in holiness. And so that's where my journey really started in the faith. And he was actually had left the Catholic faith. And so the beginning of my journey into Protestantism was like with a man who was militant against Catholicism. And so I learned, being curious in my nature, I started to read other things, and eventually ended up pursuing membership at a Presbyterian church 3 years later, because I felt it was a grave sin to withhold baptism from my children. And so, and now we're here, really. And it's interesting, because providentially, my children still have not been baptized, and it's been very heavy on my heart. And we can maybe get into why they haven't been baptized yet at some point, but if it comes up. But and so now we're having this conversation, because I very tongue in cheek, actually, Nick, before we spoke 2 weeks ago, I was like, I might just be going back to Mother Church. Like, I just keep coming to the end of myself with these Protestant churches. And then I poked fun at Nick, and then you guys invited me on. So it's a good time for me to ask some questions. So I really appreciate it.
It's funny, you said you keep finding the end of yourself. Like 2.5 years ago, I actually have the text when I sent it. I think it was in August to Tim. And I remember when I sent it, I was like meandering around a parking lot because I had called him and I was like, bro, I'm so tired. I'm so tired. Like, I just want this journey to be done. And I didn't have any additional answers. I didn't have any additional conclusions. I hadn't like read the, a set of books where I was like, oh, it's obviously the Catholic Church. I was just freaking exhausted. And so I texted him. I said, does the Catholic Church contain the fullness of all truth? And he just replied, yes. And yeah, I think he even said obviously. And I like have that screenshot because what I was looking for was like the most outrageous proposition that I had to contend with. Which is no, we have everything right. We did not miss one time on the important stuff. And so it's interesting to hear you sort of describe it as like getting to the end of yourself. Yeah. So Yeah, Connor started transitioning into Protestantism, and I, was probably very derisive of that. And then when I returned to Catholicism, he was, kind of derisive of Catholicism, like, "Oh, we just talked 2 weeks ago." He's like, I was on my way to your house, Tim, and I was like, "Yeah, we're just on our way to go worship Mary," So, it's all in very good fun. But Connor, let's just start with I'd say like the last year maybe, and what has pricked your ears and drawn your heart to start to question Protestantism as perfectly useful, and kind of why you might be considering Mother Church now.
So I think it's a few things. First, that if we do any bit of studying at all, I think we all recognize, and I've listened to your guys' stuff, that there's a cultural rot. And what, for some reason, I had this like bias toward Mother Church, and obviously part of that's just training, right? Like we're trained a certain way, and if we don't explore knowledge to challenge those presuppositions, then we can, just exist in them. And that's not to excuse them either. But I guess it's been multiple things. Mostly baptism, I would say, that exploring baptism and what it's for, and then looking at how the slide that's kind of occurred, I would say, even historically, in the last 500 years in Protestantism. So I haven't really fully fleshed this out, but I was thinking that it is an amazing testimony to Mother Church, the fact that it is here, existent for this long. Like, I don't think people talk about that enough. And whereas you look at the slide that Protestantism has gone through, in the sense of like, okay, so they reformed, there was a few things that the claim is at least that they wanted to change or they had issue with, and then now like we're full on like rainbow flags, and I mean it's just we have whole denominations that have no idea what the Lord's table is. I guess that's what's crazy to me. I think just one thing. And then recognizing that no church is going to be like, I had this idea that, okay, well, the Catholic Church has to be perfect in the sense of how it expresses itself. Like that means every member of it and every priest and every, and I think the content I was engaging with was painting the ch Mother Church in such a bad light. When I had to really go look at kind of what I was also working with in the Protestant Church, that there's failure and sin there as well.
That's an insane idea that all the people in the church must be perfect. I've forgotten who used the image, but it's a hospital for sick people, but souls. So, of course, you're going to find people who are ill there. It's a mixture of the divine and the human, and the divine part of it is perfect, but anything human is going to involve imperfection. So you see it everywhere you look.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess it maybe it was a defense mechanism. I think that knowledge can be very like dangerous if we are truly seeking to know our Creator and to know Christ, the conscience can be bound by truth. At least that's the way that I look at it. So exploring truth via Mother Church would then force me to have a reaction to it. Like if I go deal with it and then I'm convinced of it, now I have to go deal with it, and I am, priest and king of my home. I'm responsible for shepherding my children's souls. I have a duty then to them by engaging with that. So there was a hesitancy there, I think as well.
Yeah.
Mike, it sounds a lot like some stuff that you said about your experience dialoguing with Will. Did you want to comment on what Connor's saying thus far? It just sounds really similar to things I've heard you say.
It's super similar background with the fornication and the drugs and the alcohol. Congratulations on getting sober and accepting the gift of grace to even inquire about the church, because that's exactly what it is you're at that final step where now you just need to assent your intellect and your will to meet the truth of the church. And then boom, like the graces, I think when I came back to the church, somebody said to me that like the gift of baptism and the graces that come with it are like an unwrapped present under the tree. That and you know, until you go and fully sort of unwrap it and fully sort of accept the fullness of the truth of it, you don't really experience the fullness of the graces that come with it. And they flowed like crazy this year for me, man. Getting confirmed and getting my children baptized and getting my marriage convalidated and all of the incredible consolation that came with that. Because much like you, I'm not sure if this resonates with you, but the only reason I was a lapsed cradle Catholic as well, that became atheist and Protestant and back to Catholicism, praise God. But it was the reality of evil and darkness and the demonic that made me realize that God existed. That's my only really real evidence of God up until basically I became Catholic, was that I knew the devil was real. I knew the demonic realm was real. I knew darkness was real. So, but what do we know about scripture is that, or, you know, the truth of God is that, you know, the darkness can never overcome the light. That was my experience with God, was that I knew that the opposite malevolent force existed. That, okay, so of course God's got to exist. He's at the center of it all. And so speaking to what you just said, there's a fear and a trepidation there, because you know you're going to be judged according to your knowledge. And that is what is the most beautifully frustrating part about Catholicism, is that, you know, we can judge all these poorly catechized people, you know, for not taking the Eucharist in a state of grace and mortal sin, venial sin, not going to confession, etc. A lot of these people don't know, and they'll be judged accordingly because they don't know. And the more that I come to know, the more this weight of this cross bears on my shoulders, but the more that I receive the graces to bear that cross. And so when I had this confrontation with Will, and I'll say though, you know, as rough as, you know, Tim and Will seem online, and I know they certainly have that quality, there's a genuine love and care in these men that I've experienced too. And Will, like, you were always you had me on your show when I was a Protestant, and you were always very charitable. But this conversation will forever stick out to me. It's like, listen, you're aware of the teachings of the church. You're now essentially like, you run the risk of being a heretic. You're being a chooser. You're aware. And now it's either like you run away from it and don't look back, or you embrace the fullness of it. Like, what are you going to do? And that was sort of the precursor to this conversation that I had with myself, where I had this experience with the communion in a Pentecostal church. And I was like, what is this grape juice cracker stuff? I had a visceral reaction to it. And then I came to this realization. I said, wow, like, my most important job is guiding the souls of my family to heaven. How do I get there? How do I land with both feet on something that feels concrete, where I know there's guardrails, there's answers to all things regarding faith and morals. There's, you know, all these teachings we can, there's, you don't have enough lifetime to go through every single saint and all these devotions and the catechism properly to really understand it. And then as soon as I started to look at history and then praying the rosary, it was an intellectual conversion first, and then a spiritual and heart conversion second. And of course, with that has come the weight of the knowledge and understanding. I'll be judged according to the knowledge that I have. But there's a beauty in that these loads seemingly feel lighter and lighter despite getting heavier and heavier. Progressive overload of the soul, if you will, for my meatheads watching. So it's definitely relatable. And sometimes you seem like an extreme dude like me too, just judging by the path. Anybody that's an addict is a bit of a, you know, you got that double-edged sword of being type A and kind of wild and obsessive. And sometimes you need a cold, hard truth like what Will shared with me to really get those wheels clicking. So I'm glad you're here and we're having this discussion, man.
Hey, Connor, do you know any of the first councils, like the first seven councils or the first four councils of the church?
As far as referring to like Chalcedon, Nicaea, and Constantinople?
Yeah.
Not super familiar with their content. I mean, I know that those ecumenicals like existed, and I know that there was... that's not a ton about them.
Yeah. So I mean, I'm not sure what your views on Mary are, but I start out with my Protestant friends and I'm just like, look, the third ecumenical council of Ephesus, Is it 325, 381? So it's 431, 431 AD. Far enough back that most Protestants will actually trust it. The heresy at Ephesus was literally a Christological one that came in the form of a Mariological one, and it was Nestorianism. Are you familiar with that?
I'm sure it has something to do with Jesus's an ontological issue with his nature.
Yeah, like if it's as simple as Nestor, then they were wrestling at the first four councils with Jesus's hypostatic union, right? Two natures, sort of the opposite of the Trinity, multiple persons, one nature. Well, you have the basic issue at Nicaea that, whatever that is, 325 AD, Arius says Jesus is more man than God, essentially, so he's not really part of the Trinity. And then you have a compounding serial overcompensation, because then the next three or four councils are guys saying, okay, well, I don't want to be an Arianist. So at the Council of Constantinople, whatever that was, 381 AD, then it's like, I think it's Apollinaris says, Jesus, okay, they're trying to get this right. Jesus has two natures, even though he's one person. Two natures. How does this work? And so I think Apollinaris says something like, Jesus has a human body and a divine mind, because he's trying. He's like, I definitely don't want to be Arius. I learned that was bad. So Jesus had, it's really hard to get two natures, one person. So Jesus must have he must be more God than man. And it's like, no, that's wrong. That's condemned. He's got two full natures. He's fully God, fully man, and he's fully both. And then you go to council number three at Ephesus. And the only problem there, Nestorianism, is that Nestorius said that Mary was the mother, was Christotokos, not Theotokos.
Theotokos. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So just by doing that, because it sort of makes sense, like a lot of these heresies in the first place, by saying, well, Mary can't be the mother of God. He ends up splitting Christ's two natures. And of course, most Protestants realize that that's wrong. Jesus has two natures, but they're indivisible, fully God, fully man, and you can't really separate them. Therefore, it means Mary legit is the mother of God, not just the mother of human Jesus. Of course, you go to Council of Chalcedon, when they're just so confused. Okay, indivisibility, maybe it's back to one nature for Jesus because it's so indivisible. The point is, I don't know what your views on Mary are, but we regard her highly because she's the mother of God. And the basic Christology shared by pretty much any Christian requires that level of reverence.
I totally agree with that. I think, or without really doing the proper amount of work, not that it matters. I mean, the more I think about the decision that must be made in my life, I'm like, I don't need to understand everything. So meaning I have to believe something, and there's people that are a lot smarter than me that have done this and done the work. So I try not, I've gotten so used to kind of figuring it out all on my own. And I think that's a very Protestant like attribute, right? Is like, oh, you just kind of get in the text and like figure it out. But I mentioned this to Nick. I believe that as far as I know, I mean, even the reformers held Mary in high regard and would have aligned with Mother Church on their Marian doctrine. So that's like a non-issue for me, really, to be honest with you. I don't, like you said, I mean, she is Theotokos. I mean, the church has always believed that. So how that is actualized, like what veneration looks like, or the term that Mother Church uses to distinguish how the church ought to engage with Mary, are things that I just don't know about, right? Like I really just don't know.
Well, so that's why, that's a good reason to start out as a point of arrival, I guess, point of departure. Why we venerate her? You know, it's like not just the mother of human Jesus; she's the mother of God. And a lot of American evangelicals struggle with that. But if anyone from any of the Reformed traditions, like you mentioned, don't. Okay, well, that's good. So what you see is a sliding scale of Catholicity, basically, and it's a slide moving downward. The more dehistoricized, the more recent the branch of Protestant, the less in touch with the church it gets. But the problem is most Protestants taken to their own, I mean, you know, the Protestant Catholic view of Mary, Protestant versus Catholic views on Mary online are taken to be the terminus from the Protestant perspective, the terminus being like, yeah, we kind of just use our own reason. She's a woman, she's whatever. So even if you don't hold that fully terminal view of Mary is really unimportant, it shows, even if you're a Protestant that does kind of revere Mary, it shows what Protestantism tends to do intellectually. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, I totally agree. I think that was the point. I kind of lost my train of thought even earlier in the conversation. I just was like babbling for a second, but that was kind of the point I was trying to make of the slide of Protestantism. And I think you do see that specifically in Mary and the Eucharist. But yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think it's instructive that.
At the start, Connor said something really interesting, which was just plainly and simply, I was trying to explore truth. And if you really push that far enough, and I knew this when I first met Mike, I could see what he was like psychologically, that he was someone who would just keep doing that and wouldn't pussyfoot and would go all the way, which is why I knew that telling him that point about you're now on the verge of choosing. You know what the truth is. You're being called to it. And if you choose otherwise, then that's heresy. If you're someone who's going to go all the way like that, you can really think things through. And Tim's made the great point before that if you deny that Mary is the mother of God, then you end up denying the incarnation itself. And Protestants who actually think this through logically, well, you end up with Unitarianism, which says that Jesus isn't really God. And you deny the Trinity. So there is a kind of insane logic to it. And the other thing about being someone who's interested in exploring truth is that any Protestant sect you care to name will admit to you itself that it doesn't teach faith and morals infallibly, right? It doesn't have the fullness of truth in full confidence. So they're telling you, hey, I might be wrong. And that's a big thing to have hanging over you when you're a man who is leading a family and responsible for all their souls, trying to get them to heaven. The church you go to every week is telling you it might be wrong about these things that are of eternal significance, and is also telling you that all the other Protestant sects are wrong and no one quite knows exactly what Christian doctrine is. There's no real rule of faith. It's madness.
Yeah, I think I engaged with a video from Tim where I think he was arguing for, essentially, if I remember correctly, that it is logically requisite to claim inerrancy, biblical inerrancy, that you must have an infallible interpreter, and that, like, I have to go back and rewatch that video and the argument he makes. Remember, he was standing there with like a little whiteboard. It's been a while. I don't remember when he
So Connor, sorry to interrupt you, but yeah, I have it in front of me. Okay. So the first pillar that fell for me was sola scriptura, and we can't really address Protestantism without first addressing sola scriptura, right? And that was the first thing. Once that domino fell, the rest fell with it, like a house of cards, because that's essentially what it is, a house of cards. And right. So the four steps scholars made that I still have in my phone, because these four questions are so good. The first question is, were the Bible books written by a single author? No. Yeah. Okay. Is there a divinely inspired table of contents? No. Can scriptural inerrancy be known without a promulgation? No. Last one. Can promulgation be done without an infallible promulgator? Answer is no. And so, like, once I wrap my mind around those four questions, I was like, oh, yeah, okay. Right. And then you start to dive even deeper, right? Like, because everybody quotes that verse in Timothy about, you know, it being good for teaching and for reproof and whatever, whatever. So does that mean during the intertestamental period when it was being written and promulgated and spread throughout the world, does that mean like every book after that is not the word of God now? So does that mean we're going from like open to closed revelation as the New Testament was being collated and promulgated? So how do we, and these questions remain unanswered. There's all these mental gymnastics Protestants go through to try to justify this. That's an unjustifiable point. That's unjustifiable also by scripture itself. And so I'm not sure if, you know, I was going to ask you, like, what points do you have that you're like, that are stopping you from going in and embracing it fully? I know for me, it was sola scriptura, and Tim put that so well, that four-step scholar's mate. And then the questions that it opens up after that, you're like, okay, yeah, there's actually nothing there at all. There's no argument to be made. So it points in two places, but really in one place, it points to the apostolic faiths, right? So now you have orthodoxy, then you have Catholicism. And then even you dig even deeper into that, then it becomes abundantly obvious why it's Catholicism and not orthodoxy.
Yeah, that was, again, dealing with what Timothy in that argument you just, you know, put forth. Yeah, that definitely opened the floodgates for me. And I would say what's stopping me from going all the way, or I think it's been a process. I mean, I hate to make this excuse, but like, I got a lot going on in my life, and that's not a good excuse, but I guess I just need to take the time. I mean, I'm here to ask these questions too, of like, hey, what would it, you guys have, I know, gone through the process of returning. I think Nick had mentioned that, the term reversion, re-entering other church. And yeah, I think it's hard to divest myself from community as well. Like, I have men that, you know, I know that I've already kind of softened the landing for them. Like, hey, if I go back to Mother Church, like, you know, like, I'm still like your brother and I love you. We've kind of been on a journey together with a couple of different families, and, you know, it's easier for me because, you know, I'm responsible just for my two children, but they have wives, and they've gone from, you know, one of them was a Seventh-day Adventist, and now, and it's just like, sometimes it's just, it's happening so fast, and you feel like you're trying to slow down because you want to be wise a little bit as well. Like, I don't want to make emotional decisions. But I think the argument first against sola scriptura is, you can't, it's sound, and it's, and the premises are valid. So I don't know. I just have to deal with it.
Well, Mike, I mean, you can speak to that a lot too, because what you let go of and then how you were blessed afterward, my goodness.
Yeah. I was going to say that right before, because the world wants to tell you, and you get this from a lot of Protestants, especially pastors, you know, shifts in ideology or theology or whatever should take a long time. Take your time. You're almost operating under the sin of presumption in a way. You're like, you just presume like you have all this time. God's going to forgive you and have all. And yeah, of course, he exists outside of the sacraments, the church, tradition, history, the magisterium, all of these things. But we don't have as much time as we think that we do. So my sort of pushback on you is, I had this same sort of inflection point where I built this business, social media platforms, and I had all these friends that were exclusively in this Protestant circle, other than obviously Will, and then I was getting acquainted with Tim at the time we were doing CMASK together as a Protestant. I was inquiring Catholicism, but I was a Protestant on CMASK. And that was a grace in and of itself too. God was really, you know, pushing me in a direction. And I said, okay, well, I stand to lose this business, friends, I don't know, my social media following, I don't know. And it's, I guess looking back, it seems rather like inconsequential, but to me it was a big deal. But I said, you know, the good shepherd is guiding me in this direction. I'm going to deny it for the world. When we're supposed to be prepared to give up everything, everything, including our lives, right? Including our families, our friends, our businesses, our livelihoods. You got Will and Tim over here that lost opportunities because of speaking the truth. And guess what? God abundantly blessed them, blessed them beyond blessed them after that, despite some challenges. You don't have all this time, dude. And so when I took that step out, it was scary. What came with it was the exact opposite of my expectations. Because I stepped into the fullness of truth boldly, the graces flowed abundantly and they flowed quickly.
Can you be more specific?
I lost friends.
Mike?
Yes, I lost. I lost
what you
friends.
Lost and what you got.
Yeah. So I lost friends and I lost opportunities, but I gained closer relationships, closer friendships. These two men, Tim and Will, and I was actually going to talk to Nick about this at a separate point, but I won't do that on air. But anyways, Will and Tim are the godparents of my two children. So these priceless, lifelong friendships and two men and him, in which them and their families, I love dearly. Same thing with Nick. We spent time together in person. My business multiplied tenfold. I was on Pints with Aquinas. I'm on CMask. I'm on all these different opportunities. All of a sudden, it just took me by storm. These graces, God's clearly using me and the story to push me in a certain direction, maybe to get guys to come back to the church for whatever reason. It's still a weird thing. I still feel the weight of it every day, but God has me in this place. I was abundantly blessed, not just in those areas, but my marriage, getting my marriage convalidated and staying celibate in that process while we were getting it convalidated, getting my children baptized and the graces that came with that. 2024 has been the greatest year of my entire life, never mind business, because I got my spiritual life right. I got right with God. I got my family right with God. I took my role as leader of my home seriously. The number one thing, because I got right with God as an individual first, as a man first, and the blessings came with it. And I was expedient to do. A lot of people told me I was moving too fast. I said, no. But sometimes God moves fast and he wants you to move fast. He wants you to trust him. You don't have to understand all these things. I didn't understand all these things when I stepped into it. I just knew that the conviction of the Holy Spirit, Jesus Christ, was guiding me somewhere. And so I was prepared to lose it all. Instead, I gained everything and then some.
There's an underlying foundation psychologically and emotionally that I've noticed as I paid attention to Mike's journey, my own journey, watching Connor where he's at right now. And the two things that keep coming up are pride and effeminacy. That anything that keeps a man from the one true faith is pride or effeminacy. And those things take different specific forms. The pride, I think, for men is usually in the form of the intellect. And that's what exhausted me first, is when you have a slightly higher than average IQ and that has served you well in your life, you think that it will also be in service of you on this subject. And then the effeminacy is, and this isn't a dig at you, Connor, but when presented with a hard thing, any reticence to perform the hard thing by definition would be effeminacy. Just putting pleasure or comfort or peace over doing the thing that you know is right to do. And why I wanted to talk to you about this is that I think you have the intellectual honesty and the clarity of heart to not recoil at what I just said and move through it forward. And that's really seems to be, in my observations, the difference between somebody who's inside of the Catholic Church or outside of the Catholic Church after they've been obviously presented with the details. And it reminds me, despite the more Old Testament origins of the producers of the film, the third Indiana Jones movie, when Indiana Jones is faced with this crevasse, this like a door on one side, a door on the other, and what's that called, where there's a
chasm,
thank you, not crevasse, chasm. And from his perspective, it's just a sheer drop and he's gonna die if he takes that step. And no matter how he's looking at it, he can't think, you know, he can't use his whip, he can't use the tools that he knows, but he knows he has to get over there somehow. And there's this amazing moment. He blesses himself, takes a deep breath, lifts his foot up, tips forward, and it turns out there was a bridge there the whole time. But he just couldn't see it. And that is the destruction of both of those things at the same time, pride and effeminacy. Because you
Can I
have
just
to
add
admit.
Two things?
Yeah.
Can I just add two things real quick? Because you know, he's ex-alcoholic. I am ex-fornicator. I also am. I just wanted to add these 2 points because I missed them. But Connor, I struggled with alcoholism for a number of years. It was either daily or binge drinking on the weekends. And by my own strength, I could never do it ever. I always relapsed. I always fell back to it. As soon as I came back to the church, I'm not joking to you. I'm not joking, man. Like I prayed the first rosary. And once you allow the Blessed Mother into your heart, like it's game over. You're just drawn closer and closer and closer to Jesus. This pull, I think it was like a demonic pull toward alcohol, because that's where the devil knew he could get me, was lifted off of me. Like my desire to drink became zero. I didn't want it anymore. I don't drink anymore. It's sometimes still there, and they're like, oh yeah, maybe I'll have one once in a blue moon. The desire and even the way that I experience it is like I recoil. My spirit recoils from it. It lifted from this for me seemingly effortlessly, with no rehab, no therapy, nothing. It was overnight. And the same thing with lust, where I struggled with pornography and erectile dysfunction and masturbation, all that stuff. Coming back to the church, understanding chastity, understanding and virtue, and growing in virtue, and coming back to the church, that was also completely just lifted off of me. And the transformation that's had in my marriage, much less myself as a man, I can hardly put words to. So I just wanted to add that point too. Sorry, I didn't mean to hijack and make it about me. It's about you, Connor.
No. I mean, that's good. I've been sober for 4.5 years, and so I had the same experience. Just I believe by the grace of God, through the wisdom that is held in the text, even just reading it with no knowledge. Like the Ethiopian eunuch is, he asks, like, how do I know unless I'm taught? And I did have some teaching that was at least grounded in some type of historical Christianity, even though it wasn't flowing from Mother Church in the magisterium and, the traditions held in the faith. For some, I'm just thinking as I'm sitting here with you guys, I've been reading, Proverbs every day with my boys, and just so much of it is spinning through my head right now. And I'm trying to focus on you guys as well. But I guess what I wanted to say, just to respond to Nick as well, and thank you for sharing that, dude. And I appreciate, and I do see a kindred spirit in you. And I'm not afraid necessarily to move fast. My concern is just, and maybe I'm wrong, like honestly, like, right. I hope I have the humility to say that. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm lying to myself, but I don't want to think I'm right and think I'm doing this because I think I'm right. But I do need to trust, and I certainly don't want to be effeminate. I mean, I've on the process of this journey, traveling where it seems like we're heading more and more towards historic Christianity that you guys would claim would be held in Mother Church. Something Tim said was like, the closer you get back to historic, even early Protestantism, the closer we're getting to the church. Like, I'm going that way, right? So I've already done hard things, lost friends. My mentor won't speak to me because I don't worship the Old Testament people, like Nick said, as a dispensational, right? Like, I reject that system. I've being a an, being someone that believes in infant baptism has already lost me friends, right? So I'm okay. I think, I'm okay doing the hard thing and submitting myself. I think that this is just kind of like the next step. I mean, y'all have given it to me. I really appreciate the amount of care you guys have. And I honestly, I don't know if you could get four Protestants together to even do this. You do have a lot of my respect, and you guys use your gifts together well. And so I was gonna, thought maybe we would have some time to ask some questions. I don't know. We're there quite yet. I don't want to steer the bus, but
no, please. This is for you. Whatever you got on your mind.
Can I just say that point about how you can't get four Protestants together to do this is really important, because strictly speaking, there is no such thing as Protestantism. Like, there's no rule of faith. They can't agree on what it is because it does not exist. It's a misnomer. Talking about Protestantism makes no sense. It's just a bunch of guys playing DIY theology because of the pride that Nick talks about. That's literally all it is.
It's a great point.
Yeah, that hurts, but it's probably true.
Good. It hurts and then it heals. He'll also say, Will will say that too. It hurts and then it heals.
Yeah, but Connor, you sent me a bunch of questions here. Which one's top of mind? You want to go confession or something else?
Well, I think to that point, springboarding off what Will just said, that let's do confession and repentance, because to support him or the claim that he just made, and to give him just, you know, more fuel, add fuel to that fire. Essentially, anecdotally, like, I'm trying to go through church membership, and it's like, to your point, it's like, well, what church? Like, what church am I going to be a part of? Oh, well, like this church here. And I really wanted to get my children baptized, and they're like, oh, well, like, you've said some things about some things that we don't like in to the pastors there, and basically baptism is being withheld from my children because, like, we don't know if you're repentant. And that was, and I don't even, and I'm like, well, show me where I sinned, you know? And so I was wondering, what would that like look like when you, so that those in authority over us, right? And so there's a scripture, I think it's Hebrews. I might be wrong about that. Maybe it's Ephesians, but obey those who rule over you, for they watch out for your souls. Very simple text, right?
Romans, actually, I think. Not to pretend like I'm Protestant.
But the point is the point is, I guess, what does that dynamic look like how the priestly office exercises authority with the laity, and how do we work out, like, you know, anything that's explicit sin is obviously sin, right? But if I say a thing about, you know, a post-war consensus kind of held historical theory, essentially, like, are you guys tracking with me? Is anybody just,
I
keep babbling, maybe. But
yeah, no, go ahead.
Sounds like you just hurt someone's ego because of their pet theory that matters a lot to them. But the authority structure within the Catholic Church and why we have confession, that I think is fairly straightforward to explain. I can have a quick crack at it. So confession is a sacrament that Christ has instituted so that if we fall into sin after baptism, we can be restored to God's grace. And then the question is basically, but if everyone's equal and we're all just men, then how can a priest set himself above other people in any way? Like, how can he presume to be the one who can give forgiveness? And it's true that we all share a common humanity, but we're not all equal in the offices that we hold. We're not all equal in responsibility. So the priest hasn't set himself above other men. He has been set there by Christ. So the power that he has to forgive sins is one that Christ has endowed him with, and he does so in the name of Christ. And like an analogy there that might help make sense of it is when you commit a crime against civil law, then you have to stand before the judge and he can decide what the punishment might be. But he doesn't do it as just another guy. He does it in the name of the state with a power that's been given to him. So that's how I make sense of why we confess. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely. I that makes perfect sense to me. I guess the question I'm asking more would be, if my conscience, like you said, I've bruised someone's ego, but if, like, how does it work within the body if there's sin against one another? Like, who then?
You go to confession.
How does the and if my point, I guess, is if someone says, hey, and I don't want to quote the text too much, I guess, out of Matthew 18, Jesus lays out what it looks like interbody, at least I would say explicitly, it seems, for those people at the time, that if you sin against your brother, you go to him. If not, you go to the church, right? If there's not reconciliation. My point is like, how are we determining? Because so I have a disagreement with a pastor and someone who's an authority in the Protestant church that I'm like, I didn't sin. I don't see that this is sin. Like, no, you did a sin. How is that like sussed out with the priest? If does that make any sense?
It's not, it doesn't make any sense because first of all, he's not a real priest. He's got no way of deciding what sin really is, and he can't give you absolution anyway. He can't offer confession.
Correct. That's why it's so that's why it's so convoluted. No, absolutely. The question I'm asking is not about the convoluted nature and the how unreasonable it is within the Protestant church. I'm convinced of that. The question I'm asking is, what does the process look like in the Catholic church as I would relate to a priest? That's what I'm asking more. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. So sin has two components, an objective component and a subjective component. And in the latter sense, conscience really is sovereign, as you've heard Pope Francis overemphasize selectively many times over the last 10 years. So conscience is sovereign. So we have a complete moral theology that has ascertained for the Christian what constitutes a breach in the objective way of acting, rule of life. Now, in terms of ascertaining for the individual sinner whether or not you subjectively had what we'd call it law, the culpable mens rea, requisite for breaching the way of life, the actus reus, that is up to the individual one who is contrite. So you just have two components to sin, you know, like there's the objective component. Have you essentially violated nature, or in a couple small instances, have you violated supernature? And we have a long history of moral theology that's been codified into the catechisms and things like that. Then it's never contradicted itself because it's a teaching on faith or morals. And then one has to ask, okay, was I in a fugue state when I committed this breach? Was I in full possession of my faculties and things like that? So, like, I don't know, maybe it would be better to you ask us some sort of specific sin or something. I mean, even the church's teaching on cooperation, formal cooperation, proximate material cooperation, remote material cooperation, it gets more detailed than that, demonstrates what I'm talking about here. Like, for even like, is it wrong? Is it a sin for a paper boy to deliver phone books, if there are such things anymore, to people who might go procure abortions with them? No, we have to break it down categorically, you know, into what that's some level of cooperation with a sin. It turns out it's remote material cooperation, so it's not culpable cooperation, but it's technical. It's like a flowchart. And again, it's very, very Catholic. There is a method to the madness. Is this what you're asking about?
Yes. Sorry, I was very fantastic. Excited there, but yes, that. And Will, no, and what you also, your answer also helped as far as like what that process looks like. Because essentially the issue I'm having is like, and this is again anecdote, but the way it seems to me is like, it seems to me that a sacrament is being withheld from my children for something that I don't consider to have committed sin, essentially. And they're like, well, and we don't know if you're repentant because you basically, I quoted a peer reviewed study on IQ. We were having a discussion about something, and it was very much against the liberal consensus of today philosophically and about human beings and race, and that really rubbed someone the wrong way. And it was my pastor, and I thought we had dealt with it. Like, we spoke about it, we dealt with it, but then weeks later it comes up like, hey, this is why you're not going through membership. This is why we're dragging our feet, because you did this. And I was like, well, I thought we talked about that. But anyways, so essentially what I'm hearing is from Tim and Will, and is that there is a process, essentially, that the sacraments would never be withheld from you.
No, that's that would constitute grave matter if, like, a priest wouldn't baptize your children, or even if he wouldn't allow you to receive communion in your preferred method. Let's say, like, for me, I take it on the knees and on the tongue. If my priest said I couldn't do that, well, that's grounds for me now going higher than him to his authority, the bishop, and saying, well, he just withheld this, me partaking in the sacrament the way that I'm actually allowed to do. It's licit in the church. It's grave. So maybe that's a distinction between mortal and venial sin that maybe you're maybe confused about, or maybe not quite as sure about. Tim answered it very well. Would you say that may be the case here with confession and going to a priest? And because anybody withholding a sacrament from you and then him saying that it's a sin, but there's really no objective means of even identifying what that sin is pretty much the failure of Protestantism right there in a nutshell.
Right. I think that's basically what this has shown me. Is this has tipped me over the edge to show me that, like, okay, basically everything is subjective in Protestantism. Yep. Essentially,
I was
like,
just gonna say, yeah, just go and start your own Protestant sect.
Yeah,
that's how it works. I'll just go baptize my kids and I can take communion myself. Yeah, and I've got enough charisma too; like, I could figure it out.
I know you could start a cult tomorrow. You might even convince me to join. Like, you're a compelling person.
Oh, man.
Obviously joking.
Yeah.
This is literally how every Protestant sect started, really.
Yeah, someone's ego is bruised, like, and they just left.
Yeah, you don't believe all the things that we believe in this sect? Well, then you can't be part of our club. Fine, I'll go and make my own one. And then you become the guy who has the pet theories that no one's allowed to offend.
Well, I mean, King Henry said, I want to get a divorce. And the bishop said, no, you can't get a divorce. And he goes, I will demonstrate to you that I can. And, like, he was offended. He offended a cleric, and the cleric offended him, and they went their separate ways. And boom, you have, like, the Anglican Church. So tale as old as time here with Protestantism. But no, you would never. And I think Tim and Will probably can attest to this. I can attest to this a little bit as well without engaging in detraction, that you can upset priests and they will still do their duty.
Mm-hmm.
You can be in disagreement. You know, I receive communion in the same way that Mike does. I know Tim receives communion in that way. That is not the way that is comfortable for the vast majority of priests in the United States right now. Sometimes they preach against it at Mass. Sometimes there's little billboards outside of the in the narthex as you're walking into the church explaining that you're supposed to receive like this, you know? And so, like, there's a lot of ways that you can have these sort of disagreements of form, or even peripheral things. I mean, like, Tim especially says a lot of things that a lot of Catholics get upset with all of the time and has never been once refused because there is a rule book.
Yeah.
And he hasn't broken the rules. I can't. Are you here, Tim? Oh, yeah. Okay.
I'm here. I'm on my phone. So I keep recharging. The stupid charger won't work. So I keep having computer problem.
Gotcha. Yeah. So, like, there's a rule book. And unless you break the rules in the rule book, like, and that's the point, is that you can point back to a hierarchy. Like, the judge has on his table, like, a list of things. Ordinance number 58B.5, and no, you didn't breach 58B.5. You're free to go.
Yeah.
I'll say this. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, somebody threatened to write to my bishop because I was defending patriarchy online. And I don't know if he ever did, but even if he got around to it, so what? It's fine. I'm just trying to use the limited brain power that I have to try and communicate what the teaching of the church on men and women in the family is, and I can refer to all of that. It's not some fanciful original set of ideas that I've come up with. So you can write and they can say they don't like it, but it doesn't matter.
Your bishop's like, dude, do you get the irony of you literally sought out a patriarch with because of the power of fathers. You sought me out to disclaim a guy who said that fathers have power.
Yeah, like, yeah, the guy who wrote to Will's bishop, yeah, or said he was going to, about Will defending the power of patriarchy. That's hilarious. Yeah, and the irony of Connor's situation is you think that Protestantism has the lowest barrier to entry in terms of communion with Christ and communion with other Christians. And actually what it does is by supplanting the true authority, it then puts men's egos in place of that. And that's a much more fickle authority than the Catholic Church has ever or will ever be.
Yeah. And I guess that's a good transition to something that I texted Nick, that the claim against Catholicism, Mother Church, consistently is that that salvation is works-based. And what I found is that it's quite the opposite. Actually, that Protestantism seems to be works-based, because there's never any rest. If I'm constantly jumping hurdles to please men and there is no standard, then I never rest. I never have rest in Christ. I never have rest in the sacraments. I never get to rest in my baptism. I never get to rest in taking the Lord's table. So that's been just something that I kind of have been wrestling with, that, or I came to that conclusion or realization.
Well, Tim, you should talk to him about the chapter five or six with the Protestant work ethic. Oh, I literally just opened it. That's crazy. I opened the book and it was page 235, the pedigree of Western labor worship exposed. Like, so in Tim's book, Case for Patriarchy, he talks about how Protestants swapped out work for the sacraments, which is exactly what you're talking about. But Tim, I don't know if you want to flesh that out for him, because it was a revolutionary point for me.
The Puritan work ethic is a blocked wish. It's, I think Max Weber quotes another guy named Baxter, who says around the Reformation, they destroyed, you know, 6, 5, or 4 of the sacraments, as per their own claims. They destroyed 6, everything but baptism in reality. And daily grace has to come from somewhere. And when you starve yourself of daily grace from somewhere, this is the blocked wish, you need to quote unquote ascertain it from somewhere else. And so they just made it about work. You know, it's like a hungry soul eating dirt. That's what work is. Work isn't a source of much grace. The sacraments are the primary source of grace. And, you know, that's why you can look at the low countries, the Mediterranean countries, and be like, that's funny. They take like a 5-hour nap and they tend to be Catholic. And they don't come back from the nap a lot of days, but those countries have the sacraments, and the sacraments are what are necessary to get to heaven. So yeah, I mean, Germany, you could set your watch by the train or by Immanuel Kant's walk, but that doesn't mean that everyone's going to heaven. I think the other way around. So sacraments are more important than work, and there's a contraposition between the two, and therefore the surrogation of one for the other by Protestants is false.
I can tell you with confidence that I've wrestled with this too, and like I've never feel like I was at rest. I'm at the most peace and point of rest when I know I'm in a state of grace. After receiving absolution with a true heart of contrition, leaving and knowing that I can take the Eucharist the next day, that's when my soul kind of breathes this like sigh of relief. Not that I just stop, like just rest on my laurels and that's it. I'm just going to, by virtue of that, not sin anymore. But that is when I'm precisely at that point of resting in my salvation, because the faith and the grace moving together moved me to going to confession. This is why it's such a silly argument I hear from people. Well, you can just abuse the sacrament. No, you can't, because you can't trick God when you say the act of contrition. You might be able to trick your priest, but God knows if you're truly, truly sorry. And if you truly think it's your own grievous fault, if you're just there trying to abuse the sacrament, okay, you'll have to answer for that too. So, I mean, there's no way around it. God's in it, with it, through it all, created it, and will always exist.
I think what's really interesting is the point you just made and the point Tim made, I would say are held in the Westminster as well. So it's just, you know, the more I'm engaging with this stuff too, the stuff that does make sense tends to have its foundation, it seems like, in Mother Church and not the other way around. So as far as how the sacraments impart grace, how you just mentioned the marriage between faith and the sacraments, that they can't be taken from an uncontrite heart, you know, a heart that is just wants to willfully sin, right? There would be judgment for that ultimately, you know.
It's right, but what's a sacrament outside of the church? Like, there is no sacrament outside of the church, really.
Right. I mean, I'm using terms.
No,
yes,
I know.
Correct.
I know. Yeah, in this context, I know that's what I know. That's just the word you're using. I'm not trying to be argue semantics, but I get it. Yeah. Yeah. Totally.
Yeah, you are.
It's okay. It's an important distinction.
I got you. No, it's all good. I respect all you guys. You guys are here giving me your time. If you want to be specific and clear, that's fine. You're right. Correct.
I just always think it's really funny when, like, you get these guys online that are Credo Baptist or Paedo Baptist or whatever flavor of whatever Protestantism it is. Is, you know, yeah, when we call a synod, okay, under whose authority and who's at the top of this pyramid? Like, what is this? This is silly. It's just silly, but it's falling apart. It's like you're one of the many, many witnesses to the grace of God and Christ flowing through the West and converting souls, because they know it's a house of cards. It's built on nothing. Paper foundation.
Yeah.
Leads nowhere.
Yeah, it's like his beard is longest and his Bible is bound in purple leather, so I best we better listen to him. He's the one.
Is that a James White reference?
I don't know.
I was just going to say it probably is. He's the worst.
Dude, oh my goodness. I can't. Watching that guy's slide into, like, boomeristic, effeminate, like, rainbow colors in the back. I mean, that's been something that honestly has helped me be like, dude, this is bad.
He brings souls to the Catholic Church, I think. I've heard it a few times.
He helped me come to the Catholic Church.
Yeah,
I think God is using him.
Engaged with a lot of his. So maybe this is a good transition. I think you guys have, and I don't know how much you guys call it, right? I mean, I don't know how much time you want to go. We're already, you know, an hour and something. So whatever you guys want to do, but I don't know if you want to wrap or if I can ask another question.
I've got about 10 minutes. I want to know the top thing that's holding you back from becoming Catholic, like the number one thing.
Well, I guess nothing. I mean, now I'm going to have to go explore this. I mean, I'll be following up with Nick to figure out. I mean, there's a proverb, you know, something about the Lord, you know, plans a man's, or we the Lord sets the path and we plan our steps. And I think I'm kind of just being moved there, right? Like, I don't really have a choice. I have to do what I'm bound to do. And there is some fear, but I'm just going to follow the next step, which I would assume would be looking for a Catholic church in my area to at least go sit with a priest, right?
Yeah.
I don't think that there is anything holding me back, I guess is what I'm saying.
Well, you would probably find an unbelievable sense of peace and that outpouring of grace is if you did two things. The first was pray the rosary, and the second is do a general confession, because you're a confirmed Catholic, so you can go do a general confession. And a general confession is every single sin you could possibly remember. Like, take a whole day, get a notebook, go outside, pray, get an examination of conscience. I can send you one, and write down number and kind of every sin you've ever committed in your memory. Pray the rosary, go to confession. You're allowed to do this. You're allowed to do both of those things where you are right now. And I think you will be gobsmacked with where you feel you are after that.
General confession was one of the best moments of my life. It's hard, but it was one of the best.
Until now, you've never, like, you can confess your sins to your brothers. You can even talk about them out loud. I did this. I used to do this or whatever, but you're not forgiven. You owe a tremendous debt. There's no way you'll ever be able to pay it. No amount of Lectio Divina, Bible study, going to the table, nothing will ever pay that debt off. And right now, Satan has a legal claim on your soul. He owns you.
And your children's souls. And your children's souls, because they're not baptized. Yep.
And you can remove all of that with a complete leap of faith. And just in case you're like, well, I'm not entirely certain that this works, by the way, like neither was I when I reverted. I went to confession and I took a leap of faith. That faith itself was something worth trying. I literally didn't even know if confession was going to work, like quote unquote work. I was just like, okay, like I'm just going to do this. And everything else flowed after that.
Yeah. If you have no intellectual objections to the claims of the Catholic Church, and you're saying that there's nothing holding you back from becoming Catholic, then the thing that's really holding you back is just a lack of integrity and not making it a real priority in your life. You need to face that about yourself, because if you recognize it is true, you've got no doubts about it, no more queries that you need to ask us or doubts in your mind to put to rest, then you just need to take action.
Yeah, there would be more queries, but those things are small things that are, like, again, the question I would just have was, you guys already just kind of, you just answered it. I mean, Nick just said, you know, I just haven't gotten to this point of even engaging at all with this reality. Like, this has all happened so recently, where I've watched the house of cards tumble. I mean, you like, guys, literally, I just met with my pastors, you know, 2 days ago, and I was like, this makes no sense. Like, and the Lord has been gracious to me in allowing these men to act like, and I hate to say this, but like fools. Because it has forced me to reckon, to say, well, this is certainly wrong. This is certainly sin. So anyways, it's not so much that, what do I do next, or what's holding you back? Like 2 days ago, I had this conversation, and then Nick invited me on the pod. So
providence. I can't really, it's providence though.
Right. Right. You
cooperate and joyful. Cooperate providence. With grace and with providence. Right. And number one, general confession, you could get your kids baptized inside of the next 4 weeks if you wanted to.
That's so true.
And you should.
And the other cool thing, about
fervor and expediency. Sorry, go ahead.
No, just to build off what you're saying, Mike, is like general confession, because you're a confirmed Catholic, the baptism in a Catholic church is licit across the board in the same way that a non-Catholic baptism, if it's Trinitarian, is licit. So like your children can be baptized into the Catholic faith. The only thing that it will do is it puts on your soul the burden of responsibility to raise them in the Catholic faith. And so that's something that you kind of have to be ready for, that like, if you are baptizing them into the Catholic Church, now it's on you to bring them all the way through catechesis.
Well, and that would be something that would be honestly joyful. Like, I mean, I know it'll, I'm sure it'll be difficult. There'll be, you know, in the sense of that I'm a man, I sin, but I love to teach my children, even to take them through, you know, the supposed Westminster, you know, catechism, which obviously you guys wouldn't recognize as authoritative or educational.
What's that?
At all. But but anyways, I mean, there's other stuff that other questions I have, but I hope, you know, so essentially what I would say is, you know, Nick is duty bound to follow up with me, which is, it's just so interesting that I'm sitting here, and it is kind of a little bit surreal. And I think, you know, at times it seems like I've noticed on this journey that I just like watch myself do things. Like, I don't quite know necessarily why I'm doing it or decisions being made, but ultimately, you know, here I am.
And that was go ahead.
No, go ahead, please.
That was a point that I was going to make earlier, actually. I'm glad you reminded me of this. Is the way I described my reversion was that I lost a battle. I kind of didn't even realize I was fighting it. I just knew I was weary, and I just felt like this presence eternally there throughout all my years of atheism, throughout all my years of denial. And there's many years where I was able to pretend like it wasn't there, but it just kept looming. And it wasn't an argument. It wasn't a a book that I read or a podcast that I listened to because I had exhausted my intellect completely. I had thought through every conceivable argument, to my knowledge, about all of these things. I just lost. And the way you described watching yourself do things that you can't explain, but you're like compelled to do, is how I described falling in love with my fiance, where it's like I felt like I was sliding down the side of a mountain trying to find every reason why this is not a good idea. This shouldn't work. I don't want to do this. I don't know. What about all these things that I haven't checked? And all of a sudden, I'm like, okay, well, I guess I'm here now. Like, this is kind of against my will, what I know to be real. And the way I describe it is Hound of Heaven. And it's one of the most emotional concepts that I've discovered over the last several years. Is that for some reason, God sends his dogs out after certain people. He wants them, he will not stop, and they will keep barking and chasing you down until you give up. Turns out that when they catch you, they don't tear your throat out, they just lick your face. So.
I want to say two things too here as well, because this is so reminiscent of my path that happened in the last year. You're a smart guy, but being smart people means we can feed ourselves hefty doses of bullshit, meaning that we kick the can down the road because we can intellectualize and rationalize a lot of things. So don't forget that number two, it's by grace that you're even responding to this proposed truth. And so now the last thing you need to do is just step forward into it with your will and with your intellect and submit yourself to it. Because you're a smart guy, you can talk yourself out of doing this a year from now. I remember there was a co two confirmation dates, one 2 weeks from when I called my church, because I'm baptized, received, I just it wasn't confirmed. So there's 2 weeks, and then there was one a year from now. And I came to these guys and said, should I wait for next year or should I do this in 2 weeks? Or like, do this immediately. No other reason, just go and do this immediately. I was afraid. There's a lot of these things that were unanswered. But by the grace of God, responding to that proposed truth, taking that grace, stepping forward, then the graces flowed from that that answered all of these questions. And now I don't have a single question and they're all answered and I feel completely concrete in my stance. Don't BS yourself. Respond to the grace that's been given to you. And that's why you're here on this conversation right now.
Yeah, Connor, I've been pressuring you less than the other guys, but not electively. I think you know what to do, and you're there intellectually. When a Protestant gets there intellectually, this is what we saw with Mike. Just go do it. Because I mean, here's the thing: it's a systematic theology and a systematic ontology. So every answer you're going to have. Every answer that you're gonna want to find, you can go find. It'll get boring. We have catechisms beyond catechism, the only two universal ones. We have doctors beyond doctors, and in terms of faith and morals, it's boring. I mean, we have Denzinger. We're not gonna. You're not gonna find a contradiction, even in the troubling Francis pontificate. Where you're not going to find contradiction where there can't be contradiction. So I would just say, I think you know what to do now. You seem like a man who now knows what to do. We've implanted because you're different in terms of your equipoise and what you seemed ready to concede, far different than what I thought Nick described. You just seem like you're ready to go. And maybe,
Same here.
yeah.
Well, I don't know. I'm sorry if I misrepresented you, Connor. I didn't give a whole lot of detail.
He
Well,
You
no, I
Go ahead.
no, I sorry. What did you say, Tim? I cut you off.
I said he said you were a traitor. He didn't say that. He didn't misrepresent that grossly. I just assumed from a few things he said, and it sounds like Mike might have too.
Well, I would say less about Nick maybe misrepresenting me, but I've been thinking about this a lot, honestly, as I prep to come on with you guys and engage with you. But not from like, hey, I want to defend my position. I just had been praying and considering providential circumstances and things I'd been wrestling with intellectually, but also with my heart, and just realizing that like I don't want to seem wise, I want to be wise, and I'm it for whatever reason, it doesn't seem like the Protestant church has been helping me do that. It seems like I'm constantly fighting with men, and I just don't want to fight anymore. Chester, Nick made me think of a Chesterton quote. He said, the greatest thing you can do on this earth is fight a losing battle and win. And I feel like I'm right there on the edge of, you know, I'm fighting this losing battle. And then I, you know, if I come home, I win. So I do just really appreciate you guys. There's a million questions I could ask. You know, I'm sure, you know, if you're willing, we'll have an opportunity to speak one-on-one or whatever. And I can always ask Nick as well.
Well, I mean, my next show, quote unquote, we're sort of cycle who, you know, picks the topic or whatever each week. My next show is 4 weeks from now. So let's have you back on. See, we can go through any additional questions you have, see how the general confession went, how the rosary went, conversation with the local priest, like where's your heart at? And yeah, man, this is.
If you wanted to even do a follow-up next week, that there's a good chance all of us would be.
I'd be down for that. I'd take my episode and have you on again, man, 100%. And it goes without saying, even if you don't want to do that, if I can help you behind the scenes, if you got questions, and I'm sure I could speak on behalf of all these guys when I say that, we're here for you, man.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. Well, I'll definitely follow up with Nick and just text me, because we've kind of been flying, right? Like, so if you would just text me general confession, rosary, and just give me, you know, simple bullet points, and maybe we'll chat in a couple of days. But I do appreciate the you know, candor, the honesty, but also you know, the humility you guys have all shown, and you guys have a lot of my respect. I've engaged with a little bit of your stuff in the last couple of days, and not a ton of it, but yeah, I'm just, you know, very, very appreciative of you all and your ministry, and, you know, look forward to coming back on or whatever we decide. So
awesome.
For anyone listening who's in Connor's position, there's a book. It's only about 100 pages long. You can read it in a day, by Cardinal Manning. And he wrote it at the turn of the century, 1898. And it's just why I became a Catholic. And he goes through his four main reasons. And the fourth one is how he became convinced that historical Christianity is the Catholic faith. I think I would answer a lot of questions that people have about that. The first three are just basically why he became convinced with certainty of the existence of God, etc. But that number four, why the Catholic Church in particular, once you accept God exists, I think it'd really help a lot of people.
Connor, thank you for doing this, man. Thank you guys for your charity and your great questions. See everybody next week.
See you next week.
All God right, bless man. You, dude.
God bless. Take care.
All right.